Okay. I think we are.
All right. Well, I'm ready if you are.
Yeah.
You want to start me out with something?
Yes, I do. What I'd like you to begin with, if you can, is just an initial description of the social context in which you began to come into contact with drug users and the kinds of observations that initially piqued your interest.
Okay. Well, I came into contact with drug users because I was a 15-year-old piano player in Chicago. And I was working, I was probably 15 or 16, I was working with a campus band at Northwestern University, which I didn't, I wasn't a student there. And there was another guy on the band, maybe a year older than me, a saxophone player. And we got to talking, and during the intermission, we went out in the parking lot, and he produced a half pint of gin, and asked if I wanted a drink, and, you know, I didn't want to look square, so I got it down. And the next week, since I was such a good student, he produced a joint. I wanted to get high. And I said, sure. And I quickly realized that that was better than drinking gin, although I, you know, ended up doing both. So I came into contact with drug users, you could say, because I was one. Or, and I was in a trade that was, you know, where most people did do that. And I knew, you know, from my experience over the years, that the thing that I made such a big deal out of in the research that I did, namely that people often don't get high the first time they smoke dope, was something that I'd seen happen over and over again. And, you know, everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a kind of just common understanding that that was a likely thing to happen. And so when I read Alfred Lindesmith's book, Opiate Addiction, do you know that book?
Yes, I do. I know it quite well.
Oh, good. When I read Lindy's book, I said, you know, this is really interesting. Because it's like marijuana, but it isn't, because nobody gets withdrawal sickness from marijuana. So this would be a great comparative study.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about that, and then I got my PhD, and I got it very young. I was 23 when I graduated. And I didn't have a job, and no prospects of finding an academic job. I was too young. People just thought I was just a kid.
So tell me something about that. Working underage, you were working underage in the jazz clubs. Can you tell me something about that sort of precocity?
Well, the story I told you, we were actually playing fraternity and sorority dances at Northwestern. But I did play in strip clubs and bars. They weren't really jazz clubs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were just neighborhood bars or strip clubs on Clark Street in Chicago. It was during World War II. And the reason I was doing that is all the guys who were 18 and over were in the Army. And, you know, somebody had to be playing there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was me and a bunch of guys who were 4F, you know, who were physically unfit to be in the Army.
And are you, what years are you talking about there?
Talking about 44, 45, 46, up through, and then up into, I got my PhD in 51. So I'm talking about essentially toward the end of the war, late 44, 45, and then the next 5 years is sort of when I was getting my PhD. And I was working with sometimes in clubs, but sometimes, you know, with these campus bands and things like that.
And were you, did you observe any opiate addiction, any heroin addiction, or use?
Yes, I worked with a number of junkies who were, Well, the thing everybody knew is they were a terrible pain in the ass because they were very likely not to show up for work because they were standing on a street corner somewhere waiting for their connection to show up. And I can remember, you know, working in a bar and me and a saxophone player and a drummer, and the drummer didn't show up. He came in 90 minutes late because his connection hadn't showed up. And he had to stand on the corner and wait for him. And I knew a lot of junkies. They were, in fact, one of the drummers I worked with was a young guy. Well, that time he was a young guy, Frank Duffy. And Frank wanted to be a junkie. He thought it was really quite romantic. And he had a physiological thing. Like he really couldn't tolerate opiate drugs. So every time he would inhale heroin, he'd run off and vomit almost immediately. He finally had to get the nut. But, you know, there were a lot of junkies around there. It just never tempted me because I could see what how much trouble it was.
Mm-hmm. So you did not consider yourself in any way attracted to it?
Mm-mm. No, it was ridiculous. And the same thing with amphetamines. I mean, I took Benzedrine a couple of times, and all that happened was I just talked nonstop for hours. I didn't see that was any fun. So I didn't do that anymore either.
And at what point did you meet the person who became Janet Clark in...
Her name was Marilyn Bishop, and Marilyn was the girlfriend of the drummer I just told you about that left us waiting for him for 90 minutes, huh. A guy named Hal Russell, who became quite a well-known jazz player in Chicago. He was a good drummer. So I met her while I was, this would be 1954 probably. Well, I mean, I knew her before that. I met her sometime in the early 50s, mm-hmm. 1950, 51. And I got a job with the Institute for Juvenile Research, at which was a state agency, actually, run by Clifford Shaw and Henry McKay, mm-hmm. who was grand old men of delinquency research.
Mm-hmm.
And they had gotten a big grant to study teenage opiate addiction from the National Institute of Mental Health. And I found out about it, and I didn't have a job, and I persuaded them to hire me half-time to do this marijuana study that I wanted to do. And they thought it was trivial because marijuana wasn't habit for me, so it wasn't a social problem. But somehow they, I don't quite know why, they decided to take me on. And so, you know, I said to Marilyn, among other things I did, I said to Marilyn, you know, these people do life histories. So they were paying their informants, the kids that they interviewed about heroin addiction, $5 an interview. So I said I could get them to pay you $5 an interview. So why don't we do one of these life histories? And as I said in the book, she just talked in, you know, paragraphs and chapters.
Yeah.
And I didn't do anything but correct the punctuation when it was typed up.
Mm-hmm.
Else.
Yeah, and do you think, I wanted to ask about her, she seemed to know a great deal about psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
Was that much in evidence? I mean, do you think that's true, for one thing? And then another was psychoanalysis much in evidence when you began talking to people who used drugs at that point?
Well, psychoanalysis was around. I mean, it was the hip thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in graduate school, I think there was a point, I was at a party with a lot of graduate students, and there was one other guy there. He and I, we agreed we were the only two people out of maybe 50 that were not in psychoanalysis, you know, among all these students.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were on the GI Bill, and they got that as, you know, that was like medical treatment. So they got psychoanalysis as part of that. And Marilyn was, you know, I mean, it wasn't esoteric. Everybody knew about psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm. And did people use psychoanalytic concepts then to sort of give meaning to what they were doing?
Well, the ones that were in psychoanalysis did.
Okay, so that wasn't something that you would encounter sort of normally in the course of interviewing addicts?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. So she was sort of unusual in that regard.
Right. Well, she was kind of an intellectual, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of an autodidact.
Yeah. I've been
quite well read and smart.
Did she, I mean, I've read her stuff on Lexington. In your postscript, you say something about her coming back from a short jail term and giving a more detailed analysis than the one that was presented in the book. Can you remember any of that?
Not really. You know what you could look at is there's a book by James Bennett.
Yeah, I have looked at that.
And he dug into all the papers because there was quite a fight about publishing that book.
Yes.
And you know about that.
Yeah, I have read his book.
I'll just guess that what was involved is that she was bad-mouthing people that Shaw and Company didn't want to have trouble with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that they just insisted that not be in there.
Yeah. And, okay, so back a second to Lexington. Did you ever visit Lexington?
No.
Okay, so most of your knowledge of it was from people talking about it?
Entirely.
Okay.
And reading about it.
Yes, and reading, I mean, what at the time?
Oh, God, I don't know. Mez Mezro's book?
Yeah, okay.
Probably that was one. And I heard about it. You know, I got to know Linda Smith.
Yes. And what point did you?
Well, I met Lindy shortly after I graduated, after I got my PhD. So that would have been 51. I think the American Sociological Association was meeting in Chicago that summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I had become quite friendly with Anselm Strauss,
mm-hmm.
who had just come back to the University of Chicago mm-hmm. as a teacher. And he introduced me to Lindy, and this was just when I was negotiating with the people at IJR, the Institute for Juvenile Research, about this marijuana thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Lindy said to me, well, be careful with Shaw, because he doesn't like to see anybody's name on anything that comes out of there except his, which turned out to be exactly true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Lindy and I got to be very friendly, and he talked a lot about Lexington, people at Lexington, and the federal people, because he had had, there's a famous story, which I don't know if you've heard it yet, about Linda Smith and Harry Anslinger and all that, which is that after he had done his dissertation, he published an article or two, and he was at Indiana teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, an agent from the Treasury Department showed up in his office and told him that he had to stop publishing this stuff. And Lindy was a kind of bullheaded Midwest farmer, you know, no-nonsense kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy from the Treasury Department finally told him that if he didn't stop publishing, they would plant drugs in his office or his house and arrest him. So as soon as the guy left, Lundy called a friend of his who was a law professor from Indiana who was working in Washington somewhere at the time. And he said, this is what happened. Can they do that? And the guy told Lundy, give me all the details and I'll look into it. And a couple of weeks later, the assistant, some highly placed director, you know, assistant director of the Federal Narcotics Bureau showed up to smooth things over. And he and Lundy got on his high horse and, began berating this guy. You know, why are you bothering a poor professor in his ivory tower here? You should be out chasing, you know, big-time drug dealers and smugglers and all that. And the guy said, well, that's a common misapprehension about our work. That is part of our job. But the other part of our job is disseminating correct information about drugs and making sure that incorrect information is not disseminated. So you can imagine, when I heard that story, I thought, oh, boy. What am I in for?
Well,
I never heard from anybody in the government.
So you never did? Hmm? And what about other drug researchers?
I don't think, I never heard of anybody, any sociologists being bothered.
So that was really very focused on Lundy.
Yes, and it was early, you know, it was like 10, 15 years earlier. And I think they probably learned a lesson. But Lundy, was really he knew all the people at Lexington, and they knew him. And he was the enemy to them, at least as he told them.
Right. So tell me a little bit more about that. He consulted there sometimes?
I didn't know. You surprised me when you said that he consulted there.
Yeah. You know, Keith and Gallagher, I've read what I can about him, about Lundy. This was a later passing reference, I think, through Abe Wickler's. Abe Wickler used to write up all the sort of appropriation stuff at Lexington, the congressional reports. There is some, you know, record that in 1949 he consulted at Lexington. I can't imagine, I'm interested in what he did there. Haven't found anybody.
I really can't.
Yeah, because, you know, they did seem to represent him. And can you help me with why they would have, I mean, I understand, you know, why the FBN would be concerned with him in a way. It's sort of puzzling to me. But what I don't understand is why the folks at Lexington would have developed such animosity towards him.
Well, as near as I can make out, they just thought that he was dangerous. I only got it from him, and he was sort of bemused by it. I mean, Lundy was a very good-hearted guy, you know. Not overly subtle or anything, not reading things into anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's the kind of guy that was always trying to get a visiting gig at Southern California so that he could go to the racetrack out there.
Yeah.
He was a horse player. He would have been a serious horse player if he was, if he lived near a track. So he's not the kind of person that you could imagining things or making them up or over-interpreting. And I think what I always understood, and I don't know what it was based on, was that they thought that his theory was dangerous. That the idea, essentially, that anybody could become a junkie, that it was not a matter of predisposition, et cetera. They thought that was quite a harmful idea. And also, of course, all along, he early on began advocating loosening up the narcotics laws and, you know, a more rational approach.
Right. So it was his policy position.
Yeah, I think so. Although they were alert to the what they would have seen as the policy implications of, you know, just the social psychological approach to this thing.
Right. Okay, so do you know who it was at Lexington who he would have been most I'm going to...
Well, the only name I ever heard from him was Abe Wickler.
Was Abe Wickler.
Yeah, and I think that was somewhat personal.
Yeah, yeah. Makes sense.
I mean, I think they had a kind of respect for each other. That's my memory of it.
Yeah.
But that Abe really thought he was dangerous, and Lindy thought Abe was silly. Thinking that.
Yeah. Yeah. What about Lawrence Cobb?
I didn't know anything about him.
So, when you...
Been reading.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, okay. Really? I guess I'm surprised because I assumed that in Outsiders that Cobb was somebody who you were in a sense trying to refute because you know his theory about psychopathology.
Well, here's the thing: the marijuana thing. You see, for me, it didn't arise as a research problem or a researchable problem in the context of, you know, the literature on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fairly straightforward application of the kind of social psychological theory that I had learned from Herbert Bloomer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, period.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had to go, of course, read the literature. Well, the literature on marijuana was almost non-existent.
Right.
I mean, there really was nothing to read. So, since I'm not a great scholar, that was a good thing. But, you know, I read the LaGuardia Commission report.
Right.
And I read whatever there was in the literature, which wasn't much. And Cold, I remember the name, but I don't remember. And I was looking for a hook to hang this on.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed obvious that all these other theories were theories about personality. That,
mm-hmm.
that there was a kind of personality that was addiction prone, that was disposed to, you know, the standard formulation was to solve personal problems by taking drugs.
Right.
And so I thought incorrectly, by the way, I thought that my research showed that wasn't true. Well, it didn't really show that wasn't true because it didn't even consider it.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't refute it, or ignored it. And it led me down the wrong path, actually, because it wasn't until years later that I realized what that research was actually about. Because it's not about, is it personality or not? It's about how people learn to interpret their own inner sensations.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote these two later papers,
yes,
that maybe you know, in the 70s.
Yes.
After LSD happened.
Okay, wait. Yeah.
And that led me to understand what the marijuana research had actually been about. You know, namely, that's what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
It was a perfect place to study that phenomenon. Because you have this very ambiguous physical and mental experience, then you have to figure out what happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped me make sense out of the LSD,
mm-hmm,
thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was very proud of those papers, although no one ever paid any attention.
Actually, they did. I asked you about Latour's student.
Emily, yeah.
Yeah, do you know her?
Yes, I do.
And did she talk to you?
Uh-huh. Not a lot. We didn't talk a lot.
So did she talk to you about your about those papers in particular?
Probably.
I
haven't read her research, actually. I've read the book. I haven't actually finished. I started the book she did with Antoine Enyon,
mm-hmm,
called Figure de la Mature. But that's about music more. Although
yeah.
I think it deals with the drug research, too.
Yes. Well, I'm thinking specifically in Social Studies of Science, there was an article on methadone that she wrote, on the French methadone and the American methadone.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's an interesting, there's a bunch about you in there. In those papers, you are, as I took her sort of interpretation, she's talking about sort of the drug itself, the pharmacological effect, and I'm interested in that as well. You obviously thought that drug use involved some sort of socially mediated learning process, that you know, there was this interpretive moment. What she thinks is that she detects a traditional notion of how drugs act beneath or behind or before interpretation in your work, that, you know, there's something about the drug itself. Now, what she does with that, she sort of goes to those later papers and says, you know, you argue the grosser the effect, the harder it is to ignore, and that those effects then limit the culture in terms of the number of interpretations or the kind of interpretations. So what the question I was going to ask you in terms of thinking through that, and I was going to ask it much later, so what?
So much for plans.
Yeah, since it's come up, I'm very interested in that. Do you think that you learned that? Did you always think that the vaguer the effect, the more interpretive flexibility there were, or was that something that you learned over time?
Well, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, to try and think back to what I thought, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what I think is probably what I would have thought would have been based on my experiences with dope smokers and junkies. That, well, in both cases, it's an interpretive process. The getting high on marijuana is sufficiently vague that you could pretty well ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas having serious withdrawal symptoms, you'd be hard put to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
You might not understand it as you know, drugs, but you would certainly have difficulty saying nothing was happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind mm-hmm. of what I thought about.
Mm-hmm.
I have to look up what she.
I can send you a copy of the article if you want. I mean, it's online. You can also find it. But Gomart, Gomart.
That is because I'm just looking at social studies and science right now.
Oh, you are?
While we're talking. And
yeah. So I think it's
maybe here it is. Anyway, I'll look it up. No, it says can't find it on the net.
I mean, you may find it just searching on methadone. Methadone's in the title. Okay, so let's go back a bit. It's interesting. I thought you had it in for Lawrence Cobb a little bit more pointedly, a little bit more directly, because in Outsiders, there was a critique. At one point, you said that sophisticated users would sort of give you some kind of moral directive or something that was derived from psychiatric theory.
Uh-huh.
And I assume that they were, in their interviews, you know, sort of spitting back some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't Lawrence Cobb...
Common sense. You know, you didn't have to be in psychoanalysis to have the idea that sick people, you know, took drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And so you think they were just sort of picking up on that kind of vernacular,
so to speak, common knowledge.
Right.
You know, that you had to be sick to be doing something like that.
Right. Right. Okay. So the other folks you quote, like Conan Kornetsky and Robert Gerard and those, you didn't have a a real interaction with them.
No.
You were really being a good reader.
I was just being, I was covering my ass.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the literature. Okay. And I thought it was pretty stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I didn't. I mean, the first people that, the first medical, biological people that I got to know well were people like Andy Weil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who did the first biological analysis of marijuana.
Yes, and when did you get to know him?
Well, I don't think, it was in the 60s sometime.
Mm-hmm.
When was the summer of love? That was 67.
Mm-hmm. Or 68?
Maybe. I really don't remember that. But I was, for years and years, I spent summers in San Francisco. There was a big trial in Boston. This is, sounds sort of scattered, but it actually makes sense.
Okay.
A lawyer named Joseph Oteri, O-T-E-R-I, had a firm, a criminal law firm in Boston, and he was getting a lot of drug cases because they were busting college kids, you know, at MIT and Harvard and Brandeis, a lot of them. And he was getting a lot of these cases, and a couple of And, you know, most of them were, like, not really cases that you could win if it actually went to trial.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, all that Joe would do is show, would be to show up or send one of his lawyers to show up and the case would get dropped.
Mm-hmm.
So he was having a lot of success. And they were making a lot of money. And some of the younger guys in the firm, including one whose name I still see around, Harvey Silverquake, you know, still active in that field.
Silverglate?
Silverglate.
Glate. Okay.
Kept bugging Joe to, let's bring a test case.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, well, okay, we'll devote a certain amount of the money that comes in off these other cases to financing that. And these young guys went to work, and it was, you know, a labor of love.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked very hard and developed a gigantic case about how it was an irrational law. I think it was under that kind of constitutional argument that the law serves no rational purpose. Because,
mm-hmm.
in fact, there's no danger. And they kept, so that these Boston cops would arrest somebody, and they would show up with their ready to make their test case, and the Boston prosecutors would back down because they didn't want to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, they busted three kids from Brandeis who had picked up, I don't know, 20 pounds of marijuana at Logan Airport. And, they, you know, if they didn't try that case, it would mean, in effect, the law was dead. So they decided they had to go to trial. And they hired a special prosecutor. I can't think of his name. No, he was well known. He was somebody who had been on the staff of Joseph Welch in the Army McCarthy hearings. James St. Clair. That was his name. To try the case. And Oteri's people had assembled this gigantic cast of expert witnesses, of whom I was one of, you know, an army. And so we all were in Boston at various times. I mean, this was all on a pretrial hearing to throw the case out. So it was before the actual mm-hmm. trial occurred. And St. Clair had called a couple of expert witnesses, including some of the old standbys. There's an Indian guy who wrote a lot about drugs, who they used to drag in.
Hmm.
Somebody from India.
Okay.
that you'd recognize him?
Probably I would, but I can't think of it either.
So he was there, and a few like that, but on our side, there were like dozens of people, including Herbert Bloomer. And they put us all up. They had a suite in one of the downtown hotels. So I was sharing the suite with David E. Smith of the Haight-Ashbury.
Yes.
Who became a very good friend of mine. And Andrew Weil, who was, he was around. And he never testified. But he was there and I got to know him. At that time, I think he had just graduated Harvard. And he was a... an intern here in San Francisco at Mount Zion. And so I got to know both of them that way. And, you know, was just good friends with them. And I don't see much of them anymore, and he's become too famous. And David got too entrepreneurial, you know, running the clinic.
Yeah.
But that's how I got involved with him. Why did I start telling you that you asked me something?
I think I just asked you how you got to know non-sociologists, Andrew Weil.
Well, these were the medical people.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the other thing that happened, and this is really funny, because after I did the marijuana thing, you know, I wrote the book, but I wasn't involved with drug research anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1965, I quit the research job I had at Stanford and became a professor at Northwestern. And I sort of no sooner arrived at Northwestern than a bunch of Northwestern students were busted in at a party someplace, and there was marijuana there. And it was happening all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the beginning of when middle-class white kids were getting busted for that.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who brought me to Northwestern, the head of my department, was a man named Raymond Back, who was a drummer. That's how we got to know each other. And he helped the administration of the university organize a response to this dreadful event, which was what happened very commonly in universities where this was happening. They had a symposium, you know, and they,
mm-hmm.
so they got me, and they got somebody from student health, and probably a psychiatrist, I can't remember. And, you know, we each got up and said something, and that was supposed to take care of it. And I remember the student health guy who made a kind of standard speech about how terrible it was, you know, dangerous drug, etc. And afterward I said to him, hey, do you really think marijuana is that dangerous? Well, he says, not compared to alcohol. Because what we see is, you know, the number of kids who are in bad automobile accidents because they're driving drunk. Or if they get into fights, there's a lot of traumatic injury from fights, stuff like that. He said, that's, of course, much more dangerous. And, well, this was, like I said, this was happening everywhere. I started to get invited to these symposia, you know, and meetings and various conferences.
Mm-hmm. And you went, right?
Yeah.
Even though you didn't think of yourself at that point as in the field.
Right, but it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I was learning a lot. I was meeting all these people. And, you know, there were a variety of medical and biological types, pharmacologists that were in this was pretty various.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you had the old timers. And then you had people like Andy Weil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a meeting in Buffalo. A wonderful guy named Michael Aldridge. You know that?
Yeah.
Michael was a graduate student in English. His dissertation was on marijuana literature.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually the student of somebody I knew from out here, who was a professor of English there in London, who did not at all believe in dope smoking, because she, one of her husbands was high all the time. She thought it was dreadful. But she supported Mike in this. And there was this giant event. I mean, I don't know where he got the money, but there were people from everywhere. It was day after day, two or three days, nonstop talks about everything. There was some, I can't remember who came to represent the law enforcement point of view, but it was a screen because it was in the big ballroom in the student union. It was filled with kids. And this guy trying to give his paper, and there was like booing and shouting. He was quite put out.
And were these events always sort of organized around public health versus law enforcement?
Well, they were organized about all kinds of things. I mean, because then all the hustlers got into it, you know. So everybody on a campus, everybody knew that you could get money for this kind of event.
Mm-hmm.
And then they could bring their friends in. And there were all kinds of, I mean, there were some people who were regulars on that circuit, like, what was his name, Houston somebody, and Gene somebody. There were a couple. They were sort of new age psychiatrists,
mm-hmm.
Drug therapists, and Stan, I want to say Grok, is that right?
Grok?
Something like that. And there were all these drug researchers.
Okay.
And this was around the time that acid also became an issue, I think. Timothy Leary and all that. I mean, this went on for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great people in this, by the way, was Allen Ginsberg.
Mm-hmm.
Who was very interested in drug issues, probably knows that.
Yes.
And Alan traveled all the time. He knew everybody. And he was like Johnny Appleseed. I mean, he would go around, he'd call me up every time he was in Chicago and say, by the way, I met so-and-so at such and such a university. He's a physiologist. He's doing work on marijuana that I think would interest. Here's a reference to the latest paper or something like that. And what are you doing?
Uh-huh.
And he was just all over the place. I mean, he knew Lindy very well. And he knew all these physiologists, et cetera. He was just spreading the word. I mean, he was like a one-man internet.
And did you know, for instance, the behavioral pharmacology people, like Bob Schuster?
That sounds familiar. I didn't know any of these people very well, but I would meet them at these meetings. I remember once some student at Northwestern came to interview me for a paper she was doing about drug research. And she says, I mean, you had the same kind of question. Do you know this one? Do you know that one?
Uh-huh.
I could say, yeah. She said, how do you know all these people? I said, well, the federal government paid for me to meet them and get to know them. Which was literally true,
mm-hmm.
because the federal government was sponsoring most of these meetings. And then I'd meet them all there. And there were people, I remember meeting a physiologist, I think from Urbana, I don't remember his name at all, who said to me, you know, he said, marijuana is just such an interesting drug pharmacologically because it has such a decided psychological action. It's like essentially no physical activity. There's hardly anything that it affects physiologically. So you can't find it how it works, but it sure works. And he thought that was really interesting to study. So I was kind of, and then I met people like Vincent and Elizabeth Dole.
Yes.
Elizabeth?
Marie?
Marie.
Nicewander?
Hmm?
Marie, you mean Vince Dole and Marie Nicewander?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, and all those people, I mean, they were all around a relatively small number of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of on the fringe of it because the real action was with these physiologists. But I got very interested in stuff like Stanley Schachter's findings, you know, about drug action.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Dole and Nicewander stuff. Because it all went to the same point, that there was a distinct difference between the pharmacological action, which you could document, you know,
mm-hmm.
blood pressure and things like that, and these psychological consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a wonderful piece that Dave Smith published in his journal. I can't think of this guy's name, Richard somebody, who was at Stanford. I think was a psychiatrist. But he'd interviewed people who took LSD under various auspices. You know, some of them in the original experiments where it was supposed to mimic psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them where they had gone to the people who had gone to the International Foundation for Internal Freedom in Palo Alto.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to find God, and et cetera, including, you know, and people who took it to get high, and including some people who were given LSD to treat their alcoholism, some jail in San Mateo or something. And his finding was that whatever they thought was going to happen is what happened. You know, the people who went to IFF saw God, and the people who were part of the experiment said they went crazy for 10 hours. And all that went into the papers that I wrote.
So the tell me about the sort of, I don't know, genesis, sort of conceptual genesis of those papers. These are the two papers, I'm looking at your...
Right.
Journal of Health and Social Behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is which one? It's not this transaction paper, is it?
Or yeah.
It is? It is.
It was reprinted. I don't know. I can't remember. Because one of them was published twice. The transaction paper was published twice.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But there was an earlier one about history.
Yeah, history, culture, and subjective experience.
And then there's another one, which is the more general one, that compares drug use under under medical auspices and under sort of religious or whatever auspices.
Hmm. Okay.
And chemical warfare. Right? They're always left in.
Yes. Okay, so tell me about those papers and how they came out of that sort of milieu of the circuit.
Well, I was hearing all about acid, you know, and it was really interesting. And I thought, what happened was that I thought I understood exactly what was going on with acid by comparison to the marijuana thing, and that I'd read these early, you know, when I was doing my scholarly archival literature work on marijuana, such as it was, I'd run across these wonderful papers in medical journals about people who were having marijuana psychoses,
mm-hmm.
Which then disappeared. I mean, nobody had a marijuana psychosis
mm-hmm.
anymore. And I thought, I understood why that was, and I thought the same thing would very likely happen with LSD eventually. which I think is what happened. I
mm-hmm.
always tell people I made one of the few successful predictions in psychology, which is a nice prediction because it's counterintuitive. But as the LSD use increased, the amount of pathology associated with it would decrease.
Yes.
That would work.
Yes.
So, I just thought, I mean, it's kind of like the reason I did the marijuana stuff. I mean, it wasn't really because I was interested in the drug problem.
Mm-hmm.
It was because I thought it was a nice sociological thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got into it. I mean, it was just that because I was around all these people that were dealing with acid, like Dave Smith. So, you know, I was hearing all these stories. And it was, I thought I understood the rationale. And I thought I understood what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And could explain it. And I knew people like... there was a nurse named Peggy Sankoff who worked at the K-30 clinic. And Peggy is the one who invented the talking down therapy for the people who were freaking out on acid.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, she told me all about that. And that makes perfect sense from my point of view, although it does not make sense from a, particularly from a, what you call it, from a pharmacological point of view. So it just came out of that, you know, but I thought it would make a nice piece of sociology.
Okay, tell me, I have tried to formulate this question and I'm not quite sure how to do it, but when you say that the drug research, what is the role of the drug itself, sort of in the sociology of drugs?
Well, the role of it is like the role of the weather in studying social activity. You know, it's a fact that has to be dealt with. You know, like if there's a lot of snow,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have certain things that have to be taken care of. So, I mean, it's kind of like the role, I mean, I understand the effects of the drugs to be like, let's say, that aspirin lowers fever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you take aspirin and you have a fever, it'll probably come down. And that's an effect that's probably independent of what you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may decide that it has nothing to, you know, that you may not notice that your fever came down, or you may not think it was taking the aspirin that did it, etc. But that happens is probably demonstrable. You know, even with all the, you know, sociology of science caveats about that,
mm-hmm.
About how you might demonstrate that, but, you know, probably that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I understand the role of the drug. You know, that if you shoot enough heroin over a long enough time, you'll probably get withdrawal symptoms. You need to deal with that. Now, it might not be, it will be more or less of a problem depending on a lot of other things. Like how easy it is to get hold of. You know, and all that. But,
mm-hmm.
So, does that answer the question?
Yeah. What I want to think about now is I was sort of trying to get at, you know, do you think that pharmacology matters, and you know, what's the sort of limit? What kind of limit does pharmacology place? But now I want to go a little bit towards behaviorism. In the Ken Plummer interview, you talk about Bloomer's criticisms of you call it stimulus response, mm-hmm. stimulus response theory. And I'd like you to try to get at how you think about behaviorism. Does that?
Well, that's easy. I don't.
but you must have.
Well, not really. I mean, I'm not sure what you're.
Okay. I want to think about Bloomer. And you remember you said something about him being critical of this sort of stimulus response theory. Because it couldn't explain reflection, you know, this sort of internal dialogue or cognition almost.
Well, it's not that it couldn't explain it. You can deal with it. You've ignored it.
Just ignored it completely. Mm-hmm. And that is obviously that sort of gap is where you've done a lot of your work.
Right.
So could you talk about how you think about that reflective step or internal dialogue?
Well, that's one of the things that I just assume goes on. You know, that people are talking to themselves about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Simple models, chess, playing chess. If I move here, my opponent might do this, or might do that, or might do the other. And depending on which one they do, I'll maybe do this. You know, sort of thinking ahead, like what might be happening, which is essentially what Bloomer and taking from Mead understood is the the dialogue that made up the self,
mm-hmm.
and that activity, lines of activity, are built up over the course of that kind of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Now, I mean, you have to understand that in the period when I was getting my PhD and when Bloomer was writing all this stuff, stimulus response psychology was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And there were these people doing learning theory.
Yes.
You know, and it was just like all over the place. And it was, they were prepared to explain anything in the whole world.
Yes.
As a result of, reinforced stimulus response connections.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was actually irrelevant to anything that we were doing. But it was always there, and, they were like rivals in explaining what was going on in the world.
Okay. The nature of that rivalry, can you characterize it for me? Was it ideological in any way?
It probably had some ideological overtone. But, truthfully, it was a straightforward kind of professional, theoretical. I mean, sociology, mm-hmm. it always had overtones of, there's always a question about, are the things that are going on that we think are bad due to people being bad people or having bad habits or bad personalities or whatever? Or is this the way anybody would behave put in that situation?
Mm-hmm.
And the psychologists tend to the idea that there are stable elements in people, however they get there. And that's what they would argue about how they got there.
Mm-hmm.
But those stable elements would get triggered in specific situations, but they were there to be triggered. And they were automatic, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
They were learned responses. And Bloomer, of course, also criticized the idea of culture from that point as an explanation, which
mm-hmm.
has the same automaticity. As he described.
Yeah.
That's the culture.
Yes.
What are you going to do? You have to marry your mother's brother's daughter. Because that's how it is. And there's no reflection or no thinking about it. And he thought that was just silly. And but I mean, it was a kind of, in areas where fields overlap, which generally had to do with specific areas where there, in fact, was usually was a matter of government intervention, like education,
mm-hmm.
which was totally dominated by psychologists.
Yes.
And, you know, that kind of stuff. So if you mess around in education, you constantly ran up against these people who were doing that kind of thing, you know. Stimulus response explanations. And I think there was an overtone, you know, that it was, that they were more conservative. We believed that, you know, everybody was terrific and we had to put them in the right situation for their terrific to manifest itself.
So, things like Lindy's sort of critique of conditioning theory, and I mean, you would very much agree with that. He would argue against behavioristic psychologists and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, when you talk about interpretation and they talk about learning theory, you're talking about sort of vastly different paradigms.
Yeah.
Okay. So, have you kept up at all with sort of some of their attempts to replicate your study? In
You probably know more about this than I do.
Well, what I'm wondering is there is a replication of your study in it's. I'll send it to you as well. So you haven't paid any attention with the sort of at all to the life of your work within drug research today?
No.
It's amazing.
Well, I just, you know, I mean, it's like 50 years ago and I never did anymore. In fact, I learned to turn off media interviewers. You know, who would call me up after I had got burned a couple of times, you know, with people interviewing me for hours and then some weird distortion of what I had
said. Yeah.
So I used to say to them, they'd say, Professor Becker, you've done research on marijuana. I'd say, oh, yes, it was in 1953. And they'd say, well, haven't you done anything more recently? I'd say, no, but it was terrific research. They'd say, thank you very much. Great way to get rid of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So when, I mean, the 60s stuff, I mean, when you're still sort of on the circuit, you were pulled back in for a while.
Yeah, but I wasn't doing research. Yeah, then I would have known somebody was doing that. You know, was replicating. A couple of times people have sent me reprints of sort of kind of dumbbell articles I trust.
Yeah.
You know, didn't really grapple with whatever issues there were.
Yeah, that's been my sense of it. Part of why I was asking, was because they don't really get at the sort of conceptual level that you were working at.
Mm-hmm.
But they are behavioral, and they are, you know, attempts to kind of replicate parts of the study. You know, they use this, quote, same methodology and so forth. All right, so how would you talk about leaving the field? I mean, did you really never see yourself as in?
I never thought of myself as a drug researcher.
Yeah.
Any more than I thought of myself, by the way, as a researcher in education, although I did,
yes,
you know, two big studies. I mean, did a lot of research on educational institutions, but I didn't think of myself as a sociologist in education.
Or medicine?
Or, oh, God forbid. Certainly not medicine.
That was a very long time ago.
I studied students. students in medicine. I mean, that was kind of like we always said that was our major finding. The important word in the phrase medical student is student.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so...
I avoided that.
Yes. Yeah.
I always said I was a sociologist of work.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes I'd say I was a social psychologist. Then for, you know, quite a while now, I've been a sociologist of art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. Well, although I promised you that we wouldn't talk at all about deviance.
Let me tell you one story, because I've been saving this for you. It's such a wonderful story, and I know you'll appreciate it.
Okay. Is this the Danny Friedman story?
Oh, there's two stories.
Okay.
All right. The first one is sometime, I don't know when, but you might know, it was probably in the 70s. There were people at NIMH. There was a guy named, I think his name was Mitch Balter. Mitchell Balter.
Balter?
B-A-L-T-E-R. He was a physician. And there was another one named Leonard Duhl, D-U-H-L.
Mm-hmm.
These were sort of from the Kennedy Space Cadet group, you know, the young hotshots that the Kennedy people brought in. And some Israeli scientists had synthesized tetrahydrocannabinol.
Yeah.
A guy named Bashur, I think his name was. And the NIMH people had bought 40 grams of it, and they were going to dispense it to various researchers to do important research on marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a meeting in Washington, in Bethesda, to dole it out. Who's going to get the material? I was invited. I was a token social scientist. And I think it was because I knew Duhl. He had given us money to do the college study, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Studying at Kansas. So there I am with all these, famous names and not so famous names.
Mm-hmm.
Including Paris Isbell.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I thought immediately.
Yes.
So, Walter explained the situation, and Schulman created this synthetic. Now we have a way of studying it without, God forbid, people having to smoke marijuana. Which also was, you know, a technical problem, because they were never sure what the dosage was.
Indeed.
And now we have to decide how to divide it up. And we need to concentrate on the really crucial problem. And then he turns to Isbell and he says, Harris, you're the dean of research in this field. What would you say is the most important problem that has to be settled with respect to marijuana? And Isbell said, well, there's no question the important problem is the long-term effects of chronic use. Okay? And how would you propose to do that? Well, you have to do it with three animals, the rat, the dog, and the human. And it should be for at least 6 months. And how much material would you need, Harris? Well, let's see. You have to do it by body weight. He starts calculating. So he calculates and calculates. Everybody's very patient because this is the dean of research. 20 grams out of 40. Well, now all of a sudden everybody sees their interests are really threatened.
Mm-hmm.
20 grams, that's quite a lot here. Yes, it is, but... And then Balter says, I suppose that there's solid evidence that there's some reason to think that there are long-term effects. Oh, yeah. So could you tell us where? He says, well, let's see, there's the Morocco study. you know, the Morocco study? Somebody in a mental hospital in Morocco had shown that of the 4,000 mental patients there, 70% had at one time or another lost teeth. So he says there's that study. So Todd Nicaria, do you know that name?
Todd?
Yeah.
No. I don't think...
Todd was a lefty, hippie psychiatrist.
What was his last name?
Nicaria.
Nicaria.
Is that the go-to fan?
No, I got it. I got it. But I still don't recognize him.
Well, he's been around. He pops up still. I see his name occasionally.
Okay.
And he was part of this traveling group that I was telling you about, you know, that we would meet mm-hmm. in all these meetings. And he was a young, hip guy. And he said, well, Dr. Isbell, he said, have you ever visited that hospital in Morocco? No, I haven't. Well, he said, would it interest you to know that, it's true there are about 4,000 patients, but there's only one psychiatrist? Oh, I didn't know that. And so those diagnoses were not made by a psychiatrist. Oh, heavy. And then they began to smell blood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they said, well, are there any other studies? And they just pursued him until finally Isbell said, no, there is no solid evidence in the literature. Well, you know, he had never said a thing like that in his life.
Yes.
And to me, it stood out in my mind as it was like social control was palpable.
Yeah, right.
Because here were his scientific peers. He didn't dare to lie.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't dare to say what he would have said to a congressional committee.
Mm-hmm.
Because there they were at NIH. If he said there was a study, they were to go look at lunchtime and find out what, you know, go look up the study. And that would be that. Better say it.
So was there a general sort of ethos around the professional status or the scientific status? I mean, clearly in this example of Isbell there is, but of the Lexington researchers, I mean, were they cast as somehow out of the scientific mainstream?
I think nobody thought about it that much, but they were vulnerable
mm-hmm.
in this way. In other words, nobody was going to give them a pass.
Mm-hmm.
On this. You know, nobody was going to defer to them because they were, after all, the people from Lexington. They were
mm-hmm.
used to that, I think. That was his old attitude.
Yes, I think they were used to that.
And here were a bunch of, you know, younger people who are rooted not in drug research, you know, not in narcotics research.
Right.
But in physiology and neurophysiology and pharmacology and whatnot.
Yeah.
And they have their own professional base. And, I mean, they essentially didn't care what Isbell and company did, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Until it infringed on their interests, which it was doing right here.
Yes.
So that was the end of Isbell's, you know, 6 months with three animals. They just forgot about it.
Yeah, that's great.
That was a good story.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story for me. I've been using Adele Clark's ideas about illegitimate enterprises, illegitimate scientific enterprises. Do you know her work at disciplining reproduction?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's an interesting way in which the sort of old-time addiction researchers do sort of get illegitimized over time, delegitimated over time.
Well, yes, I think that's right. When it became something that people in the normal, so to speak, the normal science of pharmacology, for instance, or physiology, that they got into, these people were not, you know, I mean, they were doing kind of not great research, not cutting edge for sure. And I think it was sort of like a sheltered workshop.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody cared what they did.
Yeah.
Because were interested in, you know, it was like me. I mean, I'm interested in sociology, not in drug policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody cared as long as it didn't interfere. But when he was going to take half the material,
mm-hmm.
that's another story. Now, the other thing I wanted to tell you was I was a member of a National Research Council committee on, I think it was called Substance Abuse and Habitual Behavior.
When was this?
I knew you were going to ask.
Was it NIMH or, I mean?
It was the National Research Council.
NRC, okay.
But they only do things, you know, if they are paid for. And
yes.
The money for this came from NIDA, you know, from the Institute for
yes.
Drug Abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can date it this way.
Yeah, that's what I'll do.
Was run by Bob DuPont.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just when they were talking about putting together, amalgamating
yeah.
the Institute on Alcohol, the Institute on Drugs, and tobacco. And they were going to make one big thing that was about all that.
Mm-hmm.
And DuPont wanted to sort of get ahead of the others in the competition to be the head of the combined agency.
Mm-hmm.
So he put up the money out of his budget for this thing. And they had about, I don't know, 30, 40 people on this big committee of every variety. You know, they had some guy who had spent his entire life developing rat models for the study of alcohol addiction. And at every meeting, he would come and tell about the latest developments with rats. And nobody cared. And one of the people on this committee was Danny Friedman. Now, at some point, they were asked to produce a statement on marijuana. A policy statement about research on marijuana. And they appointed a subcommittee, which was really nuts, because it was like putting together, it was like putting the inmates in charge of the prison. Me, Troy Duster, and a lawyer named John Kaplan, who was a professor at Stanford. And John was someone who had been a kind of anti-drug thing. His attitude was that if there were laws, they were probably there for a good reason, unless you could show otherwise. And he got to know me by calling me up, that he wanted to talk to me about marijuana. He understood that I thought it wasn't harmful. He thought it probably was, and what can I tell him? And so we became quite good friends, and he was converted. Because he started to look into it, and he realized that there was, you know, no real solid basis for arguing that marijuana was dangerous. And so we understood that if we said anything rash, that it would just be thrown out. So we were very cautious. But we did suggest that maybe, possibly, the committee could consider the possibility of recommending blah, 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 you know, that it, the option of legalization be looked into. Well, don't ask. I mean, I should really hit the sand. And Danny Friedman had never showed up to one single meeting. I think he'd come to the first meeting. Never showed up. The night before this was to be discussed, all of a sudden, here's Danny, politicking, running around from one to the other, trying to line up votes to kill this. not to kill it, to table it because there was insufficient knowledge yet from the Institute of Medicine. There what would be a report one of these days. And until that happened, we shouldn't, you know, you can imagine. And he spent the whole day, the whole evening doing that, then left. If that's what he'd come for. And obviously he'd been alerted by someone to come and do that. I think this was about the time that the chairmanship of the committee had changed. It had been a psychologist named Gardner Lindsay. And I think he left. And the head of it became an old-time pharmacologist named Lou Lasagna.
Yes.
So Lou was the kind of conservative guy, you know, not a revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
So this thing came up and it's being discussed. And at the end of the afternoon, he said, "Well, look, I don't know. I have to think about this. I want you people who are telling me that it's dangerous to give me some references to literature that I can look at. And I'll look at it overnight, and we'll discuss it in the morning." Came back in the morning. I really rarely seen somebody so angry. He said, he was kind of a roughneck. He said, "If you invoke the kind of standards you're raising here, we wouldn't be able to use aspirin." This is ridiculous. There is no evidence. I think this should go ahead. So, what could they do? And this is, it's really quite interesting because it's, it was released by the National Research Council. Kind of, it was buried. I mean, they ordinarily have press conferences. They had nothing to announce it.
Yeah.
They printed 500 copies. Didn't distribute them to anybody. Kaplan leaked the story to somebody in the media. And so there were, you know, there was a flurry of news about it. This would have been in the right around 1980 or something.
Mm-hmm.
I was the one thing that came out of it for me was I met a whole lot more people, of course. You know, pharmacology and whatnot. And there's a paper that I wrote with it's a paper on my Vita. It's called Informal Social Controls. Have you seen this?
No.
Well, I don't have a copy to send you, but I'm looking at my Vita right now. It's the Journal of Drug Issues.
Okay.
1979.
Okay.
Volume 9. And it's with Deborah Maloff, who was a staff person from the National Research Council. You know, don't ask, I created a scene by insisting that she be listed as a senior author since she'd done all the work. And ordinarily, like staff people never got their names on anything. And I just ran down. And somebody named, I think, Arlene Fonaroff and Judith Roden, who's now the president of the University of Pennsylvania, who had done work on food. So those are my two stories I was saving for you. Now we can go back to your agenda.
Oh, well, I was going to go ask you about the inception of NIDA and whether you had anything to do with the federal sort of organization of drug research.
No.
So never at any point.
No, I mean, I sort of knew about it because I was hearing things from people like Andy Weil, who I got to know very well. And he was quite involved.
Mm-hmm.
He told me a great story about, which is really, it's a wonderful one. There was a meeting organized by the Ford Foundation. It must have been around the time I met him, which was whenever that trial was in And the Ford Foundation took cognizance of the potential danger of drug use, especially marijuana use, to the nation's industrial plant. Because if workers were coming in high, who knew what could happen? They were very sensitive to this particular issue. And they brought together a group of about 15 people to discuss it, and Andy was one. And he said after about an hour, it was obvious that half the scientists there had smoked marijuana, understood that it was a trivial problem in this context. And the other half had never had any experience with it and thought, you know, they had an open mind, unsullied by facts. So Andy said, wait a minute, this is what I perceive going on here. Here's what I'm prepared to do. Those of you who have never had experience with marijuana, I will be glad to provide that experience to you this evening. And then tomorrow we can discuss it. So he said that three or four of them, no, they didn't want to do that. But there were three or four others who did. And of course, they all said, that's what they're talking about. That's what all this big deal is about. It's ridiculous. So, I mean, that's kind of the atmosphere of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that actually is very symptomatic of the fact that there was a younger generation of scientists, et cetera, who knew perfectly well that it wasn't
true. Mm-hmm.
You know, of their own experience. And they were having to argue with people who essentially believed in mythology, who had no reason to doubt what they were told by people like Wickler and company.
Right.
And there was a kind of a, you know, there were people testifying. I mean, there were a bunch of old-timers who were prepared to testify to Congress. I mean, I got denounced, it was hilarious, by some old-timer out here at Berkeley. I can't think of his name. But he was a well-known anti-drug guy. And, you know, somebody told me, you were denounced before a Senate committee. No, I didn't. So there was, you know, that kind of division. But I didn't have anything to do with the federal thing.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a story that a lot of people heard that during the Carter administration, there was a drug doctor, a guy named Peter Bourne.
Yes.
Who was, I forget what his position was. He had some position.
Yeah, he was fairly high up in not SALDEP, but... Oh, which reminds me, I have to ask you about Jerry Jaffe.
Ah, that's the name I was trying to think of. Great, Jerry Jaffe. but Peter Bourne got busted. He was writing prescriptions for all sorts of stuff for White House staff. And the rumor was that Carter was going to make a move to legalize marijuana. And just then, Bourne got busted.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end of that. And everybody was very pissed at Bourne for being so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Jaffe, what about Jerry Jaffe? He was part of that NRC committee.
Yeah, okay. Did you know him in Chicago?
No.
Huh.
I met him with his committee, and, you know, he was very busy. He was very active.
Yes.
In this stuff. And he always struck me as fundamentally, like, probably an honest scientist, but also very, you know, involved. I mean, on the take from the federal government. He had so many projects, and one of those, you know, a big grant hustler.
Yes.
I think Jerry was the guy, I'm pretty sure he was the guy who told us about, he had done a study, if it's him I'm thinking of people who consumed lethal alcohol. He said in the course of his research, he had run across a certain number of people who told him they could not get drunk on ordinary alcohol. I can never remember which is lethal and which is ethyl and methyl. But the bad kind is the kind like this in Sterno. You know,
yeah, right.
And that people would...
Methyl.
Methyl. And people would filter it and drink it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was quite dangerous, you know, they'd go blind and all kinds of terrible things would happen. And he said these people that he ran across told him that they could not get a buzz from ethyl alcohol, but the kind you weren't supposed to drink, that would get them high. And they never had any of the bad effects. And he said they would drink like 8-10 ounces, which would kill an ordinary person. But it didn't bother them.
Huh.
And he was hot to find out what was going on in their metabolism. You know, the sense that that would happen. I don't know if you ever found out.
No.
Or if he ever even published it. It was really interesting. You know, you talk about the what's the role of physiology? Well, that's certainly...
Right, right.
It's like my friend, you know, couldn't become a junkie because he vomited.
Yes.
I mean, there is something going on there independent of the interpretation.
Yes, definitely. And it's interesting. I mean, I think there have been different kinds of drug knowledges that have tried to make sense of that, of individual variation and how they do it. I mean, now there's this turn to genetics as an explanation that was never, you know, that was more true in the alcohol field than in the drug field for a very long time, that there would be genetic explanations. But there are different registers to which we turn to make sense of things like that.
Right, hold on for a second. Please.
Yep.
Diane, when do you need to go?
Excuse me.
When do you need to go, actually?
No, I don't need to go. My wife needs to get out of the house at a certain time. She has a doctor's appointment.
Oh, okay. yes, all right. Well, so your sort of main experiences on those kinds, was the NRC committee the last type of committee that you were on?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so your sort of involvement with the governmental apparatus ended at that point?
Yeah.
Okay. I want you to think back. We didn't talk at all about the 1962 White House conference.
I was there.
Yes. Can you tell me about that? And I'd like you to think, I'm interested in you know, sort of... epistemic communities, the way that knowledge is organized. So think back to the 1962 committee, and I'm going to ask you to try to think about that moment as a kind of, you know, what were the dominant ways that we thought or talked about drugs at that point?
Well, the 1962 White House conference was a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got this envelope in the mail. I was out here, I was living out here because I was working at Stanford. You know, with gold lettering on the invitation, the President of the United States invites you, blah, blah, blah. But holy shit, this is really, you know, hot stuff. So I went there. There were like hundreds of people. And it was entirely a PR thing.
Mm-hmm.
Morning and afternoon for a day and a half or 2 days, I can't remember. We sat there and speeches got made at us. You know, Bobby Kennedy made a speech. Jack Kennedy made a speech. Various other people made speeches. And then it was announced that we had all agreed on the following, whatever it was. I mean, there was no meetings or discussions or anything. It was just, a ballroom filled with chairs and all these people sitting there being lectured. So there were no epistemic communities there. Those things.
Mm-hmm.
It was just PR.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lesson to me.
Mm-hmm.
About what this was all about. No, but aside from that, what were the, who was involved in, I think then there was, in sociology, there was practically nobody interested in this stuff.
And why was that?
Well, one reason was there was not much money. Because people did research on what they got paid to do research on. So I was studying medical students and college students because that's what we could get research funding for. And it was every bit as interesting to me as this. There wasn't any, there certainly was no money for marijuana research. And to be perfectly honest, I couldn't think of anything else I wanted to do about that.
Mm-hmm.
I found out what I wanted to find out.
So you really did see it as sort of an end point.
Well, it was not an end point in another sense, because it did, as I eventually saw, lead on to a much wider concern with, what it did? It tied in with things like Stan Schachter's research on when are you hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to see it in that light, as that there are these physiological things, to be sure, but that the interesting thing for a social diet is what becomes of them.
Yes.
You know, everybody knows you have to eat, you have to drink, blah, blah, blah. So there are these sort of basic physiological things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is how that gets shaped into particular kinds of desires that are built into social organization.
Mm-hmm.
It would be true of sex, it would be true of food, it would be true of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Shelter, how come people keep their houses so much warmer back east than they do out on the west coast, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that kind of stuff. So that, to me, would have been the prolongation of the work.
Yes, that has an interesting resonance, actually, with Vince Dole and his work on metabolism of appetite and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
When do you feel full?
Yes, exactly. And with Schachter.
Mm-hmm.
Schachter is another one. I mean, I saw all of that as the background to those two papers I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, if I had pursued that, that's where I would have gone. Now, somewhere in there, I'm trying to think when I met Bruno. I met Bruno just about the time that he published the first paper in English on Pasteur.
Mm-hmm. So fairly.
In laboratory in Iowa, whatever.
So in the mid 80s.
Yeah. Because he came out here to California, and there was a guy who had a little research institute here named Elihu Gerson. And Elihu invited Bruno to come and talk, and that's where I met Bruno.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had been busily teaching myself to read French so that I could finish my art book. So I read the Pasteur book, before it was translated.
Yeah. And the what appealed to you was the stuff about social organization, or how would you describe your resonance with Bruno's work?
Well, I thought he was doing the same thing with respect to science that I had tried to do with respect to art in the book Art World.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the scientific object, like the art object, is the creation of everybody who's involved.
Mm-hmm.
It had anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's this process of, you know, like the process he describes in Science in Action.
Mm-hmm.
Where the fate of the result is in the hands of the people who take it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it looked like we were doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bruno, being a French scholar and academician, would never cop to that. And that's all right, you know. But he and I got to be good buddies. But it always seemed to me that. And I had known Antoine Enyo, you know, who works in that same center,
mm-hmm.
years earlier because of Antoine worked on music. And so I had seen his first book on the music, the recording industry in France.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read a wonderful little book on how children learn about music. So that was kind of where, you know, where I saw the connection.
Yes.
But I thought it was a very deep connection.
Yes.
You know, there are some differences, but essentially it's the same kind of stuff happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was also, you know, very close to Anton Strauss, so that whole gang of people who studied with Anton were all people I knew. I was on some of their dissertation.
Right.
You know, like Lee Starr.
Yes. Yeah.
John Fujimura.
Yes. And actually, I wanted also to ask you about Dorothy Smith. Any interaction with her or not?
Not really. I met Dorothy a couple of times. Have you ever met her?
No.
She's kind of a forbidding person.
Yeah.
Heavily serious.
Yeah, I've been told that by other people, but some of the sort of talk about social organization and so forth is similar to the sort of social world Anselm Strauss folks.
Yes, absolutely.
And
I had a student named Marjorie DeVault.
Yeah, oh, she was your student? I thought she was Dorothy's.
Well, she got her degree at Northwestern. But I mean, I think it's fair to say she.
Yeah.
Student in a way.
Yeah.
I think Dorothy came to teach at Northwestern once when I was on leave. So we didn't actually overlap, but she had an enormous effect on Marge.
Yeah, right. I had Marge, actually, she's at Syracuse. I had her to speak because I'm interested in getting the social world and the Dorothy Smith's sort of institutional ethnography people to kind of merge within STS. I see these approaches as so useful for our students and so consonant with what we've been thinking. And it's really very interesting to me how there hasn't been the kind of uptake that I would have liked to see.
Well, I found Dorothy's. It's not that it was contrary in any way to anything that I thought. There was certainly a lot of overlap. But I guess my feeling was that she was fighting with different people than I was.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
And I wasn't sure who she was fighting with, and I didn't want to fight with whoever they were because they weren't important.
What about the drug ethnographers?
Mike Agar was a member of the committee, the NRC committee.
Right. Of course.
Marcia Rosenbaum and that whole gang out here I knew very well.
Right.
Sheila
Murphy, yeah.
Sheila Murphy and I can't remember them. There were a couple of guys. Stan somebody?
Stan Sachs?
Maybe. I can't remember.
at NRDI in New York City?
Well, they were connected to people in New York, but they're also out here in Dorothy, the Indians that had a social research outfit out here.
Not ISA, not where Sheila works.
Yeah.
There. Oh, okay.
Well, I don't know.
You know, it's interesting because Michael...
They all overlap so much.
Right. Michael Agar is interesting also because he, like you, you know, depicts himself as having left the field.
Mm-hmm.
And recently wrote a really interesting article about that.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you to do what you kept saying you were going to
do. Yes.
To read these things.
Yeah, I will. I also want to send you that... Marjorie Seneschal's thing about Lexington, about jazz at Lexington.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, the more stuff you send me, the better. It's marvelous being retired.
I bet.
Have time to read all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll send you the Michael Agar site because I can't think of it offhand. And I had been interested in it because his reflections are, you know, similar in a way to yours.
I mean, for a lot of people, the drugs, you know, was not really what we wanted to do.
Right.
But it was a good field to do what we wanted to do.
Yes.
So it worked for us. And Mike, you know, he got a lot of research money from them. He was part of the distant early warning system.
Yeah.
For new drugs.
Yeah, right.
I remember was very wondered if he should be doing that.
Yeah, I bet he did.
Why am I telling you these things?
Yeah. Oh, well, let me follow up on that last statement. Drugs, you know, was not what we wanted to do, because it's long been my thought that drugs enabled a certain drugs, and I'm going to use symbolic interaction for a second. Pardon me, but that drugs were important to the formation of symbolic interaction. But I'm not quite sure why.
To the formation of that way of thinking?
Yes.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, the whole symbolic interaction thing, I mean, insofar as it's a coherent point
yeah.
of view, which is the big info.
Yeah, I got that.
What it's turned into now is mm-hmm. nothing that I recognize as
mm-hmm.
anything I want to be part of.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that was formulated in essence by Bloomer in the 30s.
Yes.
And, you know, I always understood it the way I described it in the paper you saw.
Yeah.
Or in his paper on the sociological import of the theory. George Herbert Mead. You know, so he was all there long before. And then Lindy was, you know, sort of a major case, so to speak. I mean, it was a wonderful piece of research that embodied that point of view.
Yeah.
So it was good in that way, but it wasn't.
Okay, but what did drugs mean to him?
To Lindy?
Yeah.
I think he wandered into it. He was a criminologist.
Right.
And that's what he intended to do. And sort of ran across junkies like Broadway Jones, who
mm-hmm.
was the chief informant. You know, who definitely saw him. And he just thought it was interesting. Lindy was a kind of naive farm boy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, for all his, you know, immersion. Quasi-underworld and all that. With drugs, I mean, he was kind of a simple, straightforward guy. And I think it's just, you know, then I think he got his back up when they started to push him. You know, the story I told him. He just got irritated. You know, who were they to tell me?
Mm-hmm.
And then he got interested in the policy. I mean, Lindy is the kind of career that I think is very interesting. Where you only study one thing your whole life.
Yeah.
You study everything about it.
Yeah.
because, you know, he wrote a good book on drug policy.
Yes.
Got heavily into, you know, issues of around that, around, you know, political science.
Right.
Hold on for a second. So I think I don't think he had a, you know, that great a personal interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I think, in his book that he took morphine once, you know, when he had surgery for something, that he could see why people liked it.
Right, right.
But that was kind of the end of it. You know?
Right, but it certainly enabled him to do certain things conceptually.
Yeah. Well, it turned out to be, I mean, there's some topics that just really bring up certain issues in a very clear way. And it seemed like drugs did that for him, you know, the difference between habituation and addiction,
mm-hmm.
that's so central, is the perfect way to model what it, you know, the symbolic interaction point of view about human experience.
Okay, so in what sense? Perfect, in what sense?
Well, because there's such a, as marijuana was, there's such a difference between the physical action and the psychological.
Yeah.
Experience, the individual experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference shows you what's due to interaction with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, you know, with the marijuana thing, it's just so blatant and obvious that people don't know what to make of it until somebody helps them figure it out.
Yes.
And that what helping them consists of telling them what everybody knows, which is to say, culture.
Yeah.
So I think it's perfect in that way.
Yes.
Everett Hughes had... one of his many little mantras was that everything is the perfect, every topic is the perfect place to study something.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start out to study something, your job is to figure out what is the best place to study.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is very different than having a hypothesis.
Yes, right. Right. Yeah, so there was something about analytic induction and that sort of way of going about things.
Yeah, but it was also just a general field worky kind of thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
Just in the way that Bruno went to the Salk Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And says, Jesus, what are these people doing walking around in white coats?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are they?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just start out knowing nothing. I mean, it's that attitude.
Yeah.
So it's much more general than symbolic interaction.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay, but part of what I was, I guess, trying to get at with the somewhat clumsy phrasing of the question in the first place was to get at what was important conceptually about drugs, and you then produced a perfect example of that.
I did?
Yep. You said that I mean, with drugs, you almost have, it's almost like you have an assay, right? You have a way of showing what's due to social interaction and what's not.
Right, which you can then, I mean, Hughes's line always was that you studied something, you found something in the place where it was really, like, obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my master's thesis was on musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Everett had students, I mean, he used to teach a course called the Sociology of Occupations and Professions, which is the way what is now called the Sociology of Work was then conceptualized.
Mm-hmm.
And he had students studying a profession. That's what they wanted to study. Doctors, lawyers, you know, like that. So I came along, this kid, and blundered into his orbit because I had done an exercise for a class. I kept field notes on the tavern I was working in, on the musicians. And I was sent to Hughes, because this was sociology of work, and he read my field notes and treated me like, you know, the little prince. I mean, come in, Mr. Becker. Only after he read the field notes, before he was snotty as he was there. And the reason was, these people are talking very openly about how they hate and despise their clients. And his idea was, hey, if in a lowly occupation like this, people are free to say what they're not free to say in medicine,
mm-hmm.
law, you know, you can't say, I despise my patients. But probably they do.
Yeah.
Not to say it proves that that's the case, but it sure gives you a clue what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, this is such an obvious case, but it then points you toward other things, which will similarly have be involved in social interpretations and collective action.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, of course, you know, it's related in some way to everything I've done about art.
Right.
Because, of course, like everybody else, I can see a perfect coherence, you know, to everything I've done in my whole career.
Mm-hmm.
Not obvious to anybody else, but I see it.
Yeah.
I can see how one thing led to another.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I guess I see that. I bet it may be the social world's stuff knits it together in a way.
Well, you know, it's funny. Anselm and I both use that expression, but I'm not sure I ever understood what Anselm meant by it. I had that problem with a lot of things that Anselm said. I wasn't sure what he was talking about.
Do you mean that you and he meant something different?
Well, Anselm's concepts, I often thought were very vague.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't quite pin it down.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Anselm's genius, for all the conceptualizing he did, I don't think that's what it was.
Uh-huh.
I think you see what he was really fabulous at in those books where they reproduce the notes from his classes.
Yeah.
You know, and you see how he's taking apart somebody's field notes and saying, look at this and look at that. And that's
yeah.
what he did. That was just, you know, unbelievable. But I always had trouble figuring out exactly what he was talking about when he talked about social world. I mean, I knew in general, you know, there was a kind of feeling that you got.
Right.
But what I meant was something very specific, I thought, you know, very pin downable,
mm-hmm.
which was you started with X, whatever it was, and you figured out all the people that had anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Yeah, yeah.
And what their connections were, and that it didn't have a line around it, you know, that it stops here.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of a way of thinking about the connectedness of all this stuff, you know, all the dependencies and so on.
Yes. Well, I'm very interested in that because I was recently explaining to Donna Haraway, who was my thesis advisor, what I was doing in this book. And I said, you know, it's really a lot like the social world's approach that Adele Clark is using in Disciplining Reproduction. And she looked at me and she said, what is Adele Clark doing? And I thought, if Donna Haraway is asking me to explain this method, you know, I'm not sure if that's a problem or what, but...
Well, I think all of the people who worked with Anselm had that problem because... If you start out with that conception of a social world, it doesn't actually, you know, it's not exactly clear.
Right.
No, Adele's stuff is wonderful, you know. But, and I think that idea was a help to her, but I think it also, you know, it makes difficulties.
Right, right, certainly. Yeah, well, following the drugs, which is what I'm trying to do, also sort of creates its own difficulties. Okay. Well, I'm okay for now.
Okay. Did I tell you about the French guy?
Oh, yes, you did.
Okay.
And what...
I'm looking for... I found his paper in English, but did I send it to you?
You didn't send it to me online. Did you find it an electronic version?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have it.
Okay, so I'm going to send you the Michael Agar quote, the citation, rather,
okay.
For this.
You know, that are online, I can probably get them.
It is online. I just have to find it again. And
well, actually, if you can download it, because I'm not sure. Sometimes I can't get hold of these.
Yes.
Things. So if you can send the file, you know, the PDF files or whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
That would be even better.
Okay. Or print out.
Connected to. I can do this only via the University of Massachusetts. It's a long story.
I have actually the same problem. I have to go to the office. It's crazy. But I can do that, and also I will try to get Marjorie to send you this other thing. And is there anything else I promised you?
I don't know. You said there's a whole bunch of things.
Yeah. I've marked them sort of on the way through.
When you listen to the tape, you'll know what you promised.
Yes, right. And you should know that I don't have a professional. I don't have money to transcribe,
mm-hmm.
So it'll be a while till I get it. A transcription. So we'll be in touch online, I guess. And thank you very much for agreeing to do this.
Oh,
if you think of anything else.
Some of these stories I've been carrying around for years, like the story about Danny Freed.
Yeah.
I just love to tell this.
Yes, yeah.
And you're the person I was waiting to tell it to, it turns out.
Well, I'm so glad I came along. If you do think of anything more like that, do let me know.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye.